All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon. Welcome to We're Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type, warrant officer, helicopter pilot in Vietnam, 1969. We want to welcome you all to Veterans Radio today. We've got a great lineup. We're going to be talking about government policy as far as the military is concerned. We're going to be talking about weapons. We're going to be talking about some of the potential upheavals in the world with Colin Clark, who is an editor of a magazine or an online magazine called Breaking Defense. And I think you're going to find this fascinating. So I want to make sure that if you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can. The number here at the studio is 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. Or you can call toll-free. The toll-free number is 844-838-1600. That's 844-838-1600. That's toll-free, too, for all you guys, men and women out there who would like to get in on the conversation. I have a couple of short announcements today, and two of them are pretty cool. Number one is Thunder Over Michigan is coming again. Yay! And Thunder Over Michigan is going to be at Willow Run over Labor Day weekend this year. That's September 2nd through September 4th, 2017. That's Thunder Over Michigan. And the star attraction this year is going to be the United States Navy Blue Angels. How cool are that? So make sure you put it on your calendar early. Right now, they are offering discounts on tickets and all kinds of different events that are going on. In fact, they're offering discounts on the flights. You know, that you can grab a flight on some of the airlines, or not the airlines, but on the airplanes and things that they have. And I think that if you get into, go to YankeeAirMuseum.org, you can find out. It's $100 off the flight. Normally, I think one is $450. Dollars for the B-17, and I think it's $400 for the B-25. If you get in there by later tonight, you can knock off $100, and you can schedule the ride. They have them going on throughout the year, and they're in various parts of the country also. So here's your opportunity, YankeeAirMuseum.org. The Navy Blue Angels will be here over Labor Day weekend 2017. This is Thunder Over Michigan. It's a great opportunity to see all of the military hardware, especially aviation hardware that's going to be out there. There's all kinds of demonstrations and rides and incredible pilots, stunt pilots. There's helicopter rides that you can take when you're there. I think you ought to get over there and check it out. That's the YankeeAirMuseum.org. The other thing that I wanted to mention was the Fisher House. Now, many of you know what the Fisher House is, and some of you don't. But Fisher Houses are sort of like accommodations for families of veterans at VA hospitals when they're going to be there for a longer period of time. And there's about 20 or 30 of them around the country. And right now we are in the process of raising funds for the Michigan Fisher House. And I think we've got about $700,000 raised so far. We got to get up to $3.5 million. So we want to make sure that you get involved in this. And for more information on that, you can go to FisherHouseMichigan.org. And we're going to have representatives on next week to talk more about it. But it's going to be right next to the VA hospital here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's going to be the first Fisher House in Michigan. So it's kind of a really big deal. And they've started the fundraising. They've got the organization set up. They now have the nonprofit organization. They have been approved by the National Fisher House Organization. You have to raise a certain amount of money before they will authorize you to try and raise more. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to raise more funds for our local Fisher House. So we want you to go to FisherHouseMichigan.org, click on the donate button, and see what you can do to help them out. I think it's a great organization. It's a great cause. And the Ann Arbor VA, we think, is one of the finest in the system. And we'd love to have you all out there to support it, if at all possible. So let's see. What else is going on? I know. Veterans Radio is looking for hosts. and we're looking for stories. And so we want you to contact us if you would. If you've got a story you'd love to hear on Veterans Radio, please, you can send it to us by an email. You can send it to us on Twitter, on Facebook, any of those social media formats that are out there. We are looking for stories, and we're looking for contributors who would like to get some airtime. Right now, there's just two of us that are hosting programs live, and frankly, Scarlett, it gets a little bit, what the word would be, but it gets a little overwhelming sometimes trying to come up with stories each week, and we want to make sure that we answer the stories that you want to hear. So please, go to our website, click on the Contact Us, and let us know if you've got a story. We've been getting a couple of them recently, and we've heard from some people that are interested in possibly getting on air, and we're more than willing to listen to you, or maybe you can send us a demo tape or something along those lines. Well, you don't do demo tape anymore, do you? send us a CD or a link or whatever it is that you've got out there, and we would love to give you the opportunity to talk to our audience. We've been doing this now for a little over 13 years, and I think we've got a loyal audience, and it's getting bigger and bigger every week, and we need to get some younger people involved in it. Not that we're old, but we are getting up there a little bit. And so we would love to get some people from the current conflicts that can tell their own stories and bring in the issues that are so important to veterans these days. And so, again, just go to veteransradio.net, click on the Contact Us, and I promise you we'll follow up on a story and get in touch with you and see if we can work out something together. I think that would be a great opportunity. All right, we're going to take a quick break right now. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Colin Clark from Breaking Defense, and we're ready for your questions, so make sure that you're listening right after this break. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and I'm really excited to talk with our guest today. His name is Colin Clark, and Colin is a founding editor of DODBuzz.com. He previously covered Congress, the intelligence community, space industrial professionals, national security issues for the Congressional Quarterly, and was editor of Defense News. He is based in Washington, D.C., and he is now the editor of Breaking Defense. And I'll let him explain what Breaking Defense is. So, Colin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks a lot, Dale. The simple answer is we write about the strategy, policy, and politics that decide the weapons America and its allies buy and how we use them. That's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being on the program. No, I'm only kidding. There's a lot of things going on right now with the new administration and some of the things that are occurring around the world, and I wanted to ask you about some of those. So let's talk a little bit about the budget that the Trump administration has proposed. I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I'm assuming that you are more so. Can they get all the things that they want, do you think?
Well, I'd say the question really is, are they asking for enough? The Trump administration has made very clear that it wants, for example, a 355-ship Navy, which, you know, most analysts think is a good goal. But under the current approach to spending, which only actually adds about 3% to the defense budget above what Obama planned for this year, means that, especially for the Navy, there is no way in hell they are going to get anywhere near a 355-ship Navy until, if I remember correctly, 2032, which is a few years away. So the real focus right now is, what is Congress going to do? Mm-hmm. We averted a shutdown for a week, presumably to give the appropriators enough time in Congress to build real spending bills with details so that Congress actually does about the only thing it's actually charged with doing in the Constitution, which is passing the defense spending bill. And supporting the nation's defense. It's the betting is in Washington that there will be some kind of massive, they call them omnibus spending bills, and the defense budget will probably be the primary part of that, but we have very few details about what will actually happen, what the Trump administration actually wants to see happen now, beyond mm-hmm. avoiding a shutdown. So, longer term, they're not doing nearly as much as their rhetoric would seem to indicate they want to do. Mm-hmm. Shorter term, it's very unclear what they actually want to achieve.
I was curious because I was reading your website. We're talking with Colin Clark, the editor of Breaking Defense, which is an online, I guess, an online magazine, for lack of a better term. And there are all kinds of great stories here, and I really encourage our listeners to go to this site, where they were talking about, in one case you were mentioning, the Navy especially, is in trying to figure out what type of ships and submarines and other types of things that the Navy is going to need, and because, you know, we're dealing with other powers now, it seems, and you know there's concern about North Korea, of course. There's concern about the Chinese building up their Navy, and that we, you know, our Navy is, if we don't get the money that you were mentioning before, that the number of ships and submarines is going to go down as other people's ships and submarines are going up.
Yep.
And so what do you see as the main concern right now for the Navy as far as, replacing ships? It looks like, you know, some of the ships have been around since probably I was on them.
Some. The real concern, I think, although they don't like to talk about it a lot publicly, is with the size of both the nuclear missile submarines, the boomers, and then with the attack subs. The head of Pacific Command earlier this week testified before the House Armed Services Committee that he only had about 50% of the submarines he needed to operate just in his area of operation. So add the Atlantic and the Red Sea and a few other places, and I'm willing to bet that they're probably about 60 to 65% short of what they need, which I don't know about you, but I'd like to know what the aging Russian nuclear subs are doing,
yeah.
And more importantly, maybe what the new Chinese and North Korean subs are doing. So I think submarines, both boomers and attack submarines, is where the greatest concern lies for the Navy. But, you know, there's also just the simple fact of numbers of the surface fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And the surface fleet's been shrinking for about 12 years now. And unless they really, and they're looking at maybe 302 in another 5 to 6 years, if they're lucky. And most of the analysts we've spoken with don't think that's enough. The 355 may be too ambitious, but somewhere in there, we've got to get our replacement numbers up just to do basic presence operations, let alone be ready for a true hot war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was noticing one of your articles talked about the chief of naval operations, I think his name is Richardson, was talking about how we need to replace these ships at a quicker pace, and
yep.
that he feels that the design time can be cut in half almost, it looks like.
I think that's more of a hope than a target. But
okay.
it is, you know, they've looked at the time it takes to, I mean, let alone a carrier, but just to replace something like a frigate or a destroyer. And those timelines have just gotten longer and longer and longer and longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that from a source who is familiar with the study that the Navy did a study looking at whether they could get to 355 ships with their current acquisition setup, you know, where they front load most of the money on the first one of the new class of ships, and then they basically try to lower costs as they go along. Combined with all the regulations they have, they concluded there was no way they could get to 355 ships anytime in the near in the next 15 years.
So, what do you think is the real threat out there? Is it the Chinese or is it the Russians? I mean, I don't even think the Russians had an aircraft carrier. I think they had one, didn't they?
Well, they do have one very creaky one that luckily gives off a lot of smoke most of the time when it sails.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of hard to miss. But the I'd say the real threat is North Korea, which is pressing very hard to build submarines capable of launching nuclear missiles. And it's unclear because, you know, the intelligence people don't want to talk about it publicly.
Mm-hmm.
They're not there yet, but Admiral Harris last week said this was his greatest single concern. If they can miniaturize a nuclear warhead, put it on a submarine launch ballistic missile, and they've already got submarines that may be capable of launching them.
Mm-hmm.
That would be his greatest strategic threat and concern in the next, he didn't give a timeline, but I'd say the next 5 to 8 years.
That's a kind of a scary situation. I mean, you know, nobody really seems to know really what's going on in North Korea. I mean, you know, the leader is is a little bit out there, and, you know, we don't know.
I think you're being kind.
Well, I'm trying to be, you know. You never know who's listening. You know, what I want that first target to be. But the idea I just never understand why the Chinese want to get so involved with the North Koreans, because I'm afraid that North Korea could pull the Chinese into something they don't want to get involved in.
Well, but the Chinese see it more in terms of their border with North Korea, and it's hard to get a really good sense of this, but I have talked with two Chinese scholars over the last few years who said their biggest concern is the collapse of North Korea, because it could send hundreds of thousands of people north into China seeking refuge, food, and water, to put it bluntly.
Right.
And the South Koreans are also very worried about that, but China sees North Korea, one, as a useful lever against us, and it is, and two, as a threat to themselves, and one that they don't want to stir up too much. So, you know, have they gotten to the point where they really will act and tell the fat young man to change his behavior? I don't think we know.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump seems to think that he and President Xi from China are pretty good buddies now, but I remember a Bush who said that about Putin. So I'm always skeptical of such assessments.
Well, well, we have to be skeptical, because we don't know, you know, who's necessarily telling us the facts, and, you know, which facts are they telling us? That's the question. Is you know, how much can we trust our intelligence service in working with the other intelligence services? I know that you are in contact probably more for your articles and so forth. What is your impression of what American intelligence operations are like today?
Ooh, yikes! Can you narrow that down a little?
Sure. Okay. Let's say. What do you think is the intelligence that we've got on, let's go to a different part of the world for a while, we'll come back to Asia again. How about in the Middle East? What do you see as the, we don't have a policy, that's the problem. What you see
maybe the state of intelligence there?
Yeah,
I think
going,
in the Middle East it's actually pretty good.
Yeah, what are we learning over there?
Well, you know, we've been there a long time. the Jordanians and the Israelis are both very close allies, very helpful. The French have excellent sources in the Middle East and provide us with a lot of information. And we've had time over the decades to, you know, build up human intelligence networks there. The real question is how well do our intelligence people assess what they have access to?
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that gets back to your point about strategy. You know, we could have the best intelligence in the world, but if we don't really have a strategy for what to do with it, you know, aside from indications and warnings, it doesn't really help you very much.
Mm-hmm. I want to digress just a little bit here for our audience. We're talking with Colin Clark, who's the editor of Breaking Defense, an online magazine about everything that has to do with the military and what's going on in Washington at the same time. And my question, I guess, is for our audience to understand is that the politicians in Washington are the ones that make the final decisions regarding any of our interventions anywhere, correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Civilian control of the military is rock solid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to make sure our audience understands that, because sometimes people are under the impression that, you know, the generals can go off and do whatever they want. Well, they can't. And
well,
I guess they could, but
Trump, they have more freedom than they used to.
Mm-hmm.
And he made that clear in the Oval Office. I think it was week before last, when he said, you know, I give them authority to do what they need to do. What that means is kind of unclear, but it sounds a lot broader than certainly what President Obama did.
Mm-hmm.
Or President Bush, for that matter.
Were their cabinets more hands-on, and they wanted to know more?
One of the problems with Obama was his National Security Council, which ran the military. You basically didn't need a Secretary of Defense because you had these, for the most part, very young people with no operational experience of any kind in the White House from the National Security Council running operations. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't work very well. You know, that's one of the reasons the counterterrorism stuff did pretty well, because it required a presidential approval, and once it got that, the operation could just go ahead. And the NSC didn't really have time or access. But on larger commitments, like we were literally ready to announce that we were engaging in joint operations with the French against Syria. And the night before, the White House Chief of Staff and President Obama were in the Rose Garden, and somehow or other decided not to go ahead with the announcement for which the French Minister of Defense was in Washington to make.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, this was basically driven by people in the National Security Council who feared that, you know, we were making a commitment that we couldn't really keep. And yet, you know, everything had been ready for the rollout. Literally, the speech was written for both our defense secretary and their minister of defense.
Mm.
And then, poof, it vanished.
Wow. And we end up with, what, 3 or 4 more years of or continuing chaos, right?
Exactly.
It seemed that way. When I'm reading these articles in your magazine in Breaking Defense, there was one about the War College, and a War College, I know from other people that we've had on the program, are constantly looking at what if scenarios, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and where to, you know, put our resources and so on and so forth. And one of them I see just the headline says no new powers are needed, and Are there concerns of other smaller countries, I guess you could say, like North Korea, that are going to try and get in on the worldwide market?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that. Could you maybe rephrase it a bit?
I'll try. Are there other people that want to become bigger players in the world?
Oh, yeah. You know, the North Koreans and the Iranians have both, I think, correctly concluded from watching our behavior and the Russians and the Chinese that if you want to be a big boy in the world, you have nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And you have them ready to use whenever your country is threatened. And it gives you a heft that a conventional military just doesn't give you. Is it a good idea for places that are that isolated and into which we and other countries of the world have so little transparency?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. But the problem is when you're dealing with, you know, places like that that are so cut off in so many ways to the outside world, how do you make accurate assessments of their abilities? How do you influence them? Because they're not, but China, for example, and we have huge amounts of shared interests.
Okay. I'm going to have to cut you off here for just a second, Colin. We got to take a real quick break for the news at the bottom of the hour. So we want to make sure if you have any questions for Colin or comments, give us a call here on Veterans Radio, 734-822-1600. And we'll be right back after the news. Stay tuned to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio. I'm your host, Dale Thronberry, today. My guest is Colin Clark. He is from Breaking Defense, an online magazine about the everything that's going on in Washington regarding the military. And we've kind of reviewed what's up with the Navy and so forth. And I'd like to go to a little bit more on land right now, Colin. So I was reading one of your articles about the GAO nitpicking marine amphibious combat vehicles. What's up with that one?
You know, the Government Accountability Office does a lot of really fabulous work because they are meticulous. But they also tend to look at weapons and go, okay, we've got a standard set of parameters for a successful weapons program. And if you're not following it, you're not doing a good job. And sometimes they're right. And I'd say probably about 20 or 30% of the time, they're beating a dead horse. And I think this is one of the times they're beating a dead horse. The Marines got the message when they screwed up on the expeditionary fighting vehicle. They came back. They made the requirements much, much, much more reasonable. And from everything we've heard from the Navy and the Marines, they've got it pretty well under control. And GAO is basically pointing at a couple of things that certainly don't seem to be that important. And telling the Marines to back off. We, as I'm sure you can tell from the tenor of our piece, we did not agree with their conclusion.
Yes, I did get that impression right there, because I'm looking at a picture right now of this monstrous vehicle. And, I mean, I understand in talking to the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans that we've talked to, this looks like something that has probably been needed for quite a while, especially, you know, with all the IEDs that they continually run into. But it sounds like the GAO does run into these delaying issues, not only with the Marines, but also with Air Force jets and planes and so on and so forth. And it seems like whenever they do that, that the price seems to go up.
I don't think it's fair to blame GAO for that so much as it is to blame usually Congress for its meddling. And then on the other hand, often the companies for screwing up, and lastly, for the folks who write up the requirements at the joint requirements. God, I'm blanking. The JROC. And, you know, the services draw those up, and sometimes they're just ridiculously detailed. Sometimes they're hoping for the moon, and sometimes they keep changing the requirements, which is one of the things that happened with the Joint Strike Fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, only one of the things that happened with it. But, yeah, I don't think you can blame the GAO for a lot of it. I think you can usually praise the GAO for detailing in painful detail just what's been gotten wrong.
Well, I know that their response, I don't know if what their overall responsibility is for keeping things on budget and making sure that they, you know, that they're completed in a reasonable amount of time and that they meet the specifications that the different branches are looking for and whatever it is that they're trying to build. If we were to look at our military today, I'm not just asking an opinion. I'm not looking for facts so much here. Is our military prepared for most potentialities?
At the middle and lower end, I'd say yes. Counterterrorism, yes. Traditional special operations, probably 60%, but not as good on a lot of the sort of older, more traditional, you know, training, foreign militaries, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But on the high end, we are in, I don't think dire straits, but we're in dangerous territory. The Air Force has admitted for, I think it's about 5 years now, that in a high end fight, they're only about 60% ready. The Navy, you know, we talked about the lack of submarines and the relatively small size of the fleet. We're short of Mark 48 torpedoes, for example. the Marines and the Navy's aviation wings are both in pretty rotten state. Their readiness levels are, in some cases, below 60%.
Really? Is that because they haven't had any new aircraft introduced?
That's a lot of it. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's there. You know, we're flying old planes that were designed to fly a lot less than they have in the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that the budget has not had enough money in it to really keep up with the larger depot work that's required to keep, you know, these complex systems going and to rebuild them.
Well, that's true. And they've, of course, I mean, all the equipment has probably gotten more and more sophisticated as it goes along. You know, we're not flying biplanes anymore, and we're not flying Hueys anymore either, which were fairly simple. You know, I look at these new helicopters, and I just kind of shake my head and go, nope, I don't know if I could figure this out. I got the principle down, but I don't understand all the different gauges and things that are on there.
But that's one of the nice things now, though. Fly-by-wire makes it a lot easier.
I agree with that part. It's just no more seat of the pants stuff. just go. So we've talked a little bit about our air power, and we've talked a little bit about our sea power, and we're just touching on, you know, what's going on with the ground troops. I have a question for you. I was reading an article the other day that I thought was rather interesting about that there's a rumor out there that they're investigating the idea of rolling the Marines into the Army. Have you heard anything about that?
You know, this one, whenever the budget sort of gets tight, and this always pops up. The Marines were almost abolished, I think it was, in 1949.
Hmm.
But this was talked about in the late 90s after the wall went down. And I don't think it's likely to happen anytime soon, but the battle for resources and for missions between the Army and the Marines, especially in the Pacific, is intense. And what we've seen the Army doing the last about 2.5 years is designing their forces in the Pacific to be a lot more like the Marines.
Well, they're a lot more, you know, small unit strike force units that are out there, it seems.
Exactly. And they've also tried to build in more organic air support. But, you know, it's kind of hard for the Army to do that since they don't have anything except helicopters.
Right. I was going to say, the Army's going to get jets now, too? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well,
that's kind of scary when you think about all these different aircraft running all over the place. Well, you know, I guess the question would come down to one of the things is there a need for a conventional army any longer? You know,
I think as a guy who started off covering the Army, I am deeply sympathetic to the boots on the ground argument. You know, you can do amazing things with advanced technology, with precision weapons, with the brilliant command and control systems we've got now. But if you want to defeat an enemy, take his territory, hold it, and force him to come to terms, you gotta have people on the ground. And nobody is structured better than the Army to do that. Although I think a lot of people would argue that the Army could be much better structured for the wars we're going to fight than it is now.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, there was a lot of talk in the 1990s about Doug McGregor's famous book, Breaking the Phalanx, which argued for, in a lot of ways, Army units to be a lot more like the Marines and to have their logistics built in instead of having, you know, separate logistics units, so that especially artillery, heavy infantry, and the advance elements could operate much more quickly. You know, they wouldn't have to do what they do now, which is for every conflict, we sort of rebuild the Army units as we decide what they're going to do, instead of having units that are designed to do certain things and being ready to go out there. And the other one I would offer is the 101st and the 82nd are really cool, very elite organizations, but when's the last time they did what they were designed to do?
Right.
You know?
Well, the last parachute jump?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I think you can actually make a better case for the 101st than the 82nd, but still.
Yeah. Well, do you think that the we're talking with Colin Clark, who's the editor of Breaking Defense, an online magazine, all things military, all things in Washington. I really encourage you to go to their website. It's breakingdefense.com, and there's just all kinds of great stories in there that really help you kind of understand a little bit more about what is going on in the military. Because, you know, when we talk with people, veterans especially, who you know, have served over the last 10 years, let's say, you know, they've worked extremely hard. They've done great jobs. They do a lot of working with the civilians, as you mentioned before, the boots on the ground kind of thing, in, you know, winning the hearts and minds. I guess that's what I'm trying to get to.
But the counterinsurgency.
The counterinsurgency thing. But the problem always seems that we're never there long enough to actually, for people to trust us entirely. And I certainly understand that. I wouldn't want to stay, you know, anywhere for 10 years or something like that myself. But do you feel that the branches of the service, I guess, are large enough to be spread out as thin as they are today, or do they need to be increased?
No, they do. They need All of them. The Air Force has really taken the lead on this.
Mm-hmm.
But the Army, the Marines, and the Navy, especially the Navy, if they're going to have anything like this 355 ship Navy, they're going to have to bring in, I haven't seen a number yet, but I'd be willing to bet it's at least 20 to 30,000 more people, just to get them going. Mm-hmm. How many they would need overall, I don't know the force structure analysis well enough. But it's going to be a serious issue over the next, let's say, 3 to 7 years as we figure out what kind of velocity there's going to be to our military buildup, if, in fact, we'll stick with it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they're, well, again, it's Congress having to allocate the funds to do these things, and of course they have to have some leadership that says this is what we really need and this is what we can't go without.
And you know, this is the kind of thing where, like, your audience mm-hmm. is really important, because nobody respects someone's opinion on these matters more than those of a veteran. And if your folks hear this stuff, think for themselves, and, you know, pen letters to their congressmen and their senators, mm-hmm. it really does make a difference. I can tell you that I have talked with a number of legislative aides and congressmen over the last 20 years I've been doing this, and they have said, you know, especially on large spending decisions, they listen to the people who send them letters, who phone in, and if they're identified as veterans, it carries, I'd say, 100 times more weight.
Oh, really? I might have to. We'll have to encourage everybody out there to get involved in this process. You know, if you're confused and you're not happy with what's going on, send them a letter. Give them a call. I'm sure that they would love to hear from you.
And tell them what to do.
Yeah, and tell them what to do, because it doesn't seem. No offense to some of the younger people that I see that are in Congress and so forth, is that they, many of them don't seem to have the background and experience to make some of these decisions that are going to be coming up in the next couple of years.
We've got very, very few. I don't remember the number, but the number of people with active military service who've actually carried a gun, flown a fighter or a bomber or sailed a ship is, if I remember, it's below 20 in the entire Congress.
Right. Yeah. I know that they've been encouraging. There's a lot of organizations that are out there that are trying to get more and more young veterans involved to, you know, because it's changed. I mean, the whole thing has changed. You know, I can't admire anybody more than I do John McCain, but our time has passed almost. And
yep.
we need to get some of this these new men and women involved, because the makeup of the military has changed so dramatically over the last 40 years.
Mm.
And since we don't,
like most people in the military now are married to people from the military.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Which is, you know, A, they're married, and, you know, a majority are now married, and B, they're married to other people in the military, which is, especially for a guy like you, I mean, that's a huge shift in the last 20 years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was married when I was in Vietnam, and I was kind of it was unusual for so many, you
yep.
know, so many of the guys that were there with me that were married at the same time. And I don't see them reinstating the draft. I don't think that would go over too well politically.
Right. No. And, you know, I'm very divided on the draft. On the one hand, we need to have a society that understands what this all means and what it requires. But on the other hand, you want to have a really competent fighting force.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a draft, unless it's a general draft to mobilize for war, I just don't think it works that well.
No, probably not. I mean, yeah, they have to be motivated. Most people I knew that were drafted were not quite as motivated until they got in country. Then they were very motivated because they wanted to get home.
Exactly.
You know, but the idea of that they were the ones that would seem to always be questioning authority and so forth. Nothing unusual. Well, you know, we got about 10 minutes to go, and Colin, I want you to hold on because we got to take another real quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about where you may think the next hot spots are. Okay. So we're going to be taking a quick break. We're talking with Colin Clark from Breaking Defense. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with Colin Clark, who is the editor of Breaking Defense, an online magazine, talks all about American military and what's going on with everything military, it seems like. It's great articles, and I think that I encourage our listeners to go to their website, which is breakingdefense.com, and you're going to find out all it's nicely broken down by different services and in different areas that we need to look at, you know, that says air, land, sea, space, Congress, intel and cyber, and strategy. So let's try to talk a little strategy here, Colin. What do you think is going
to,
where's the next, where do you see us in a year? What do you think is going to happen?
Always a dangerous question to answer.
Yeah, all of the above, right?
Well, you know, something's going to happen with North Korea, whether it involves actual fighting, cyber attacks, electronic warfare, I'm not sure, but
do you think that
we've
that,
got to have points of leverage?
Yeah, I was going to say, do you really think that it's possible that somebody would you know, use a nuclear weapon somewhere? Could that would kind of
I think it's highly unlikely.
Yeah. I mean, even people that are a little bit out there, as we've already mentioned about the leader of North Korea, I mean, his country would be just obliterated.
Which hopefully he knows. I mean, you know, we don't know a lot about him, and he clearly is sometimes erratic by our standards. But almost everything he's done does make a horrible type of logic. He has leveraged our insecurities and our vulnerabilities with quite a lot of intelligence, and, you know, look at how we're still grappling with how to make him change his tune. Mm-hmm. He's done a smart job. Evil job, but smart.
Well, yeah, he's keeping us off balance, that's for sure. What about, let's go back to our friendly Middle East.
President Trump said Jared Kushner can fix it if anybody can. So I guess that's the answer, right?
I guess so, unfortunately. Or maybe fortunately. I don't know. I don't know. I can't make heads or tails of what the Trump policy is right now.
Hopefully that's by design, because if not, it means that we're in uncharted territory.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know he's not going to take any baloney from anybody, and he's probably going to react as we saw with the rockets into Syria. But what, you know, I mean, we've only got 3 minutes really left to go, and I know we can't solve the problem in Syria in 3 minutes. But do you just see that just continuing on as the way that it has been?
And all the intel analysts and senior people I've talked with for the past 5 years look at this as a 15, 25-year war, and it's not going to get solved. We will contain ISIS, I think, pretty convincingly.
Mm-hmm.
We will not destroy the threat. We will limit it.
I agree with you. I think that we will be able to limit it. I don't know. I mean, when you've got people that are quote, radicalized, but, you know, they're radicalized because they've been in a war for how many years, and, you know, they're starving, and, you know, they don't feel safe anywhere. So there's always going to be that group of people that are going to respond to that. And if we can just contain them in that area, it's going to be better for us. But I still feel terrible for the people that live in Syria and Iraq and in that part of the world. I don't know what we're going to do about that. That's for another show, I guess.
I think that's at least the show in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you see as the next big scenario as far as Congress is concerned? Are they going to do you think that they're going to be able to budget what the president wants, or is it going to be another using tape and duct tape to fix this?
Well, duct tape is the miracle cure for everything, right? So,
yes.
And that's generally the way Congress works. So I think that's what we'll see in this next omnibus.
Mm-hmm.
The real question is, do they start building towards a real increase in the budget for 2018, which is, this next budget? And right now we really don't know, because President Trump's is only 3% bigger than what Obama planned.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't go near accomplishing what the service chiefs all say is the minimum they need to start improving readiness.
Well, Colin, I know we can't solve the problems, but I would love to have you back on our program sometime in the future to talk about some of these things again. And I appreciate you very much taking the time of wherever it is that you are talking to us for the last hour.
My pleasure. Look forward to it.
Thank you very much. All right. We've been talking with Colin Clark of Breaking Defense. And I encourage you to go to their website, breakingdefense.com. I think you'll find all kinds of great information there. Two other things I wanted to remind you of is to make sure that you support FisherHouseMichigan.org. There are donations to build our Fisher House in Ann Arbor. And also go to YankeeAirMuseum.org, because Thunder Over Michigan's coming up and you can get a discount on some of those flights on the B-17 and 25. So go to their site as well. So I think that's about it for today. So until next week, you are dismissed.